Overlooking test results, are surgical masks useless versus the swine flu? And is nursing still recession-proof? Plus, we're going to take a look at myocardial infarction. If that's what you're looking for, you found it. It's The Nursing Show. Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of The Nursing Show. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and I'd like to welcome everybody to the show this week. We have a lot going on this coming week. In fact, as many of you are listening to this, I'm actually out in Vegas at the Blog World Expo and New Media Expo. They've combined this year, and I'm excited about the fact that I'm going to be able to attend the healthcare bloggers meetings out there and get to meet a lot of the healthcare bloggers, nursing bloggers, and others that I have been contacting and corresponding with for several years, and now I'm going to get a chance to hang out and meet up with them face-to-face, so I'm looking forward to that, and I'll have some reports on that both on the website and in the podcast in the next couple of weeks, so you'll want to stay tuned here to The Nursing Show. And of course, I want to remind all of you to head over to nursingshow.com. Check out the website there. We have articles that get posted throughout the course of the week, and of course, all of the show notes for each of the episodes. This is episode 101, so there's a lot of information for nurses, nursing students, and educators available here in past episodes, and you can find all of that by looking at the category Nursing Podcasts and checking back into the past episodes. You'll find links to everything we talk about in every episode, all the news articles, and additional resource links for any of the tips of the week. So it's a great way for you to catch up on what's going on here at The Nursing Show and with nursing in general. Don't forget, if you have any comments or suggestions for me, you can, of course, leave those comments right over on the site. There's a link at the top or the bottom of any article there where you can click and just leave a comment and share your comments with the rest of the readers there at the Nursing Show site. Or you can send me an email to comments@nursingshow.com. I love to hear from all of the listeners. I always get back to you and respond to every single email I get. And I really look forward to hearing from you, whether it's suggestions, tips, ideas, links on news items. It tells me what's important to you and what you'd like to hear more of here in The Nursing Show. And of course, that means that things you hear in The Nursing Show often come from listeners. This week's tip is one example of that. We had a nursing student check in wanting to hear a little bit more about cardiac care and cardiac nursing, and we're going to talk about myocardial infarction a little later on in this episode. Let's jump on into this week's news, and we'll lead off with a story I found over at medicinenet.com. This is a report from an article and study that was published in the September 28th issue of the Archives of Internal Medicine, looking at the occurrence of healthcare providers missing key test results, even when there was an electronic alert, when there was easier electronic access. And it points out to me that we have to remember that despite the fact that we're trying to put so much into an electronic, easy-to-read, easy-to-access format, where it's easier to share information between healthcare professionals, and yet we still can't do anything about it if they aren't looking at the alerts that they're getting, if they aren't actually going in and looking at the electronic data that is sent to them. And this is a concern when you're trying to get a patient that is waiting for test results to maybe be discharged or waiting for test results to determine a course of action, and a physician or other care provider has neglected to review the test results that were forwarded their direction. And so this is an ongoing problem, and it points out that we really can't just rely on the electronic nature of what we're doing with patient care records to solve all the problems. You know, electronic medication restrictions are not going to keep us from making medication errors. That in and of itself is merely one measure of many that must be implemented. And the same is true for test results and lab results and imaging results. all of these things have to be followed up on, not just by the healthcare team, but also by the patient. I mean, I think that there is some responsibility that lies with the patient to be an informed member of their own healthcare team. And either the patient or their family members and caregivers are actively involved. And if they don't hear back when they were supposed to hear back, let's say that somebody went in for a CT scan and was told they'd hear about the results the following day. Well, at the end of the day, the following day, if it's getting on towards the afternoon, that family member, that patient, should be contacting their healthcare team, someone on that team, to follow up and say, I have not heard. And this is how they can get that care response that they need. And I think it just is incumbent upon the nursing staff, because we are often that liaison between the patients and their physicians, to make sure that we are continuing to be their advocates in these situations, that we are aware of test results that the patients are anticipating hearing about, and helping them to find out when they're going to get that information by relaying their concerns onto the rest of the healthcare teams. I think that's important and incumbent upon us as their patient advocates, directly interacting with them every day. We move right into our next article, going from high tech to very low tech. What good are regular surgical masks in preventing the spread of viruses from patient to healthcare provider and from healthcare provider to patient? Well, according to one article I found at news.com.au, a professor in virology in Australia is basically saying that surgical masks used in hospitals for decades offer little or no protection against airborne viruses, that healthcare workers trying to use these as a way to prevent the spread of viral infections really offers no definitive safety or protection from airborne viruses such as the flu, swine flu, and other airborne viruses. And so that healthcare workers really need to understand that it is important for them to have the access to and the understanding of how to properly fit an N95 particulate mask or respirator mask, because surgical masks in and of themselves do not offer a significant protection level. And I think that this is something that many of you may know, but you know, I come from the emergency services background as originally as a paramedic, and so we got hammered over the head with we had to be able to use N95 masks as part of our personal protective equipment. But when I went through nursing school, there was little to no discussion of N95 masks and no instruction on how to properly fit an N95 respirator to your face and make sure that there were no gaps, that there were no air leaks, that you were breathing through the mask and not around the mask. And so I wonder if this is not something that your general healthcare provider, healthcare team in a facility are even aware of. And so I would just point out this article, and I'd urge you to check the link in the show notes and follow up with your own infection control staff in your facility or with your local health department. Find out what are the measures you can take to get the right equipment to protect you as we roll into the flu season, as more and more people are getting the H1N1 infection. We are seeing that's having a really devastating effect, at least in lost work and time away from, you know, when you're recuperating in the adult population, people our age. And I think that's something we need to be aware of. I know of several people in the podcasting community in the healthcare environment, several physicians and several other providers at different stages of healthcare and health careers, that they have all succumbed to the H1N1 virus. Most often when an older family member, a child, came home from college, was sent home from college with H1N1, and they rapidly infected the entire family. So it's something that we should be aware of and protect ourselves as much as possible. Finally, a brief look at an article I found in the MiddletownJournal.com. This is from Lebanon, Ohio, and there's an article there written by a nursing student, and she was writing an article or a column for their Healthcare Today column and talking about is nursing still recession-proof? Something we talked about when the recession kicked in and all the economic troubles happened, and everybody was like, oh, but healthcare careers are really going to be strong and are going to survive, healthcare and teaching and things like that. But we have seen that while that is partially true, there are some things that we're not seeing. And we are seeing that some nursing students are having difficulty moving themselves into the work environment from the school environment because of the unavailability of jobs in some of the marketplaces. And so I wonder if that's something you're seeing in your area. I urge you to read this article. It's well written. It's a nursing student who's about to graduate and wondering what her options are when she graduates, wondering if her nursing class and guarantee of employment is really going to be there. And I would expect you to, I would wonder what your experiences are in your facilities and in your region. Are you seeing nursing graduates having difficulty securing positions in that area? Time for the tip of the week, and this tip comes in thanks to an email from one of the listeners who wanted to hear a little bit about cardiac care and a review of nursing strategies and interventions for cardiac care. So we're going to start off with a look at acute myocardial infarction, and so let's talk a little bit about that. Myocardial infarction patients require some specific nursing skills in assessment and in providing certain key interventions to help these patients survive a very difficult and dangerous time in their lives. And it is incumbent upon the nurses that are caring for them to provide a significant amount of that care. What is an MI? Well, an MI is a myocardial infarction, the death of the cells in the heart muscle. And this can happen for a variety of reasons. According to this very booky definition, it is resulting from an acute decrease in coronary blood flow or an abrupt rise in myocardial oxygen demand without sufficient coronary artery perfusion. Now, this is usually in the left ventricle, but it can happen in any part of the heart. And it really comes down to either a blockage in an artery where there is not enough flow to a certain portion of the cardiac muscle, or the patient has become active to the point that the heart can no longer supply itself with enough oxygen to continue beating. And so some of the heart muscle tissue begins to die. So what are we looking at here? Well, the key thing we think about when we think about the myocardial infarction or heart attack is that pain, that chest pain, people clutching their chest. And that is an important part of the picture. But I do want to point out that in up to 25% of MI cases, there is no complaint of pain. There is a complaint of some mild discomfort, sometimes complaints of things like nausea, complaints of just not feeling well, or just shortness of breath. So you need to really be a clinical investigator and use your other assessment skills, not just relying on pain. But pain is an important key factor in some cases, in most of the cases. So we want to make sure we're looking for that as well. I have this reminder here, L plus OPQRST. This is something I picked up as a paramedic back when I was in the paramedic days before I became a nurse. And I think it's a good, valuable tool to keep in mind. L, first of all, for location. Where is that pain? Is it in the chest? Is it in some other part of the body? But then also OPQRST, which stands for onset. When did the pain first start? And most importantly, not just when, but what were you doing when the pain started? You know, were you out raking leaves? Were you doing yard work? Were you climbing a flight of stairs? These are things that can give you an indication if there was effort involved that this was brought on by an increased myocardial oxygen demand along with some kind of reduced blood flow. Provokes. What causes the pain? What makes it worse? In other words, is it worse when you have to get up? Is it worse when you become more anxious? What are some things you're doing? Does it hurt worse when you move a certain way? These are all good questions to ask. Quality. This is one of the most important questions. And you know, you can just sit there and go, what is the quality of your pain? And a lot of patients are going to look at you and go, quality of my pain? What are you talking about? I don't know, it just hurts. Well, you have to be, again, a little bit of an investigator. And a good trick that I learned a long time ago was to ask the patient, what could you do to make me feel the same way? In other words, how could you make me have the pain you're having right now if you had to make up a way to do it? And they'll come up with some very creative ways to tell you how they feel. And you can use that to really get a sense of how bad the pain is. You know, if somebody says to you, look, I'd back my truck over your chest, then you can get a sense of crushing or severe pressure chest pain. And so that's a better way to get to the root of the quality of the pain than just asking the patient, hey, what's the quality of your pain? Also, radiates is important. One of the significant manifestations that we might be looking for is radiation of that chest pain down one or both of the arms, up into the jaw and into the back or the shoulder blades area. All are indicators that this may be cardiac related pain. Severity of the pain. This is your 1 to 10 scale. You want to ask them to rate their pain, and you want to ask them to rate their pain at the onset and ask them to rate their pain after any intervention you perform or after any change in that pain. You want to make sure you're documenting these things carefully. All of these can help to point to ways to improve your interventions later on. And time. Again, how long has the pain been going on? This kind of goes back to onset, but onset I think is more about what they were doing, not when they were doing it. So how long has the pain been going on? Have you ever felt this kind of pain in the past? So it can be about that kind of time as well. All important aspects to keep in mind regarding pain. Now, again, we talked about the quality of pain. Some of the things you might hear from them is it's crushing, it's gripping, it's a stabbing pain, it's an aching pain. They may talk about it being constricting or numbing. They feel numbness or tingling in their arms or their fingers. That pain goes down the arm and then they feel tingling, vice-like or a heavy weight on their chest. So what kind of assessments are we going to be doing? What kind of diagnostics are we looking at here? Well, with most of these patients, we're going to be looking at getting their patient history very quickly and as part of the process. And we can do more than one of these things at the same time, especially if we have some people assisting us. Get a patient history, look at their risk factors, because if this is a new onset cardiac case, they have no prior cardiac history. What about their family history? What about their key risk factors? Are they a smoker? Have they had a family history of cardiac or coronary artery disease? All of these questions are important to ask, and so you should really get a thorough and quick history on these patients. Electrocardiogram, the EKG, ECG, however you want to say it, these patients need a 12-lead EKG. The rule of thumb I've heard in many places, if they come into the ER, they should have an EKG within 10 minutes of coming through the door and complaining of chest pain. We need to get a good look at what's going on with the heart. Now, important note, an EKG is only diagnostic of an MI about 50% of the time. So it will not give you a false positive, but it will not, if there are no findings in the EKG by itself, that is not an indication that there is no MI going on. It only shows that the EKG doesn't see an MI. So you have to keep that in mind, and you have to tell the patient, and this is where our nursing education of our patients comes in. We need to inform them just because the EKG doesn't show anything, we still need to really look at our labs. And possibly things like ultrasounds or echocardiogram. The echocardiogram is going to look at the cardiac output, look at the amount of volume moving through the heart, and it will give an idea of that ejection fraction. How much of the blood that's in the left ventricle is being successfully pushed out into the aorta? And this ejection fraction, this percentage of the output, is going to give an indication of the health of the ventricles. Lab tests are finally the kind of hallmark of cardiac assessment, and this is because if the echocardiogram doesn't show anything or is non-conclusive, the EKG is non-conclusive, the patient has sort of hazy risk factors and patient history, how do we know this is an anxiety attack, or how do we know this isn't related to perhaps an infection that is settled in and around the cardiac or in the thoracic area? we can use other tests. And lab tests are really going to bring this home. So let's look at these lab tests as we wrap this up. So we're going to be talking about lab tests here and the cardiac enzymes that are the key factors we're looking for. Remember, when the body experiences an injury, whether it's a traumatic injury or an injury like this is occurring in a myocardial infarction, the dying or dead cells release enzymes as they are starting to break down. And it's the reading of the elevated levels of those enzymes that tell us that there's a specific type of injury going on. We look at these proteins, and first off, we look at the creatinine kinase, the CK. But we look at a specific type of CK, the CKMB, which looks at the myocardial bands. This is a specific subtype of the creatinine kinase, and there are several different types, CKMM, CKBB from the brain is CKBB, MM is skeletal muscle breakdown. So this is specific to the myocardial muscle, and CKMB would be one thing we're looking for. One thing to keep in mind, this will be starting to be released about an hour after the onset of the MI, so this is something that has been a continuous problem. We want to get in there and treat an MI as quickly as possible because the more time they spend with the MI ongoing, the more cardiac muscle they lose and the ability for them to have a full recovery are slowly decreasing. So we want to make sure we get this taken care of quickly. But if we don't have a CKMB level that's readable until about an hour and it doesn't reach a peak level until about 24 hours, it's going to be difficult to make that definitive diagnosis for the physician. So but this is one lab level we look at. Also, the LDH, the lactic dehydrogenase, is another one. This will elevate steadily and reaches a peak about 48 hours later. Again, not really timely in what we want to look for. Another cardiac marker is the troponin I or troponin 1, and this is a one-hour release and a 24-hour peak, but it can be read for days, and this is something to keep in mind. It's a lot like the CKMB, but it lasts in the system for a couple of days and doesn't rapidly go away. So if somebody had a heart attack and didn't come in right away and was experiencing problems, this could give us an indication that there was a cardiac event a day or so before, and it will stay in the system long enough to be read at a later point. So what interventions? Well, this is another old paramedic term, but I think it's valuable for nurses to keep in mind for cardiac patients. There are a few key things to remember for an acute onset of an MI. Patients that are in a cardiac floor, we could do a whole other show on that, and we probably will, but this is something that we want to think about with any patient with a sudden change. So even the cardiac floor patients, if they have a sudden onset of chest pain, we are going to probably intervene with some or all of these interventions. Mona greets all patients, okay? What are we talking about with Mona greeting all cardiac patients? First of all, morphine. Now, they may be done in different orders, but this is the way we remember it. Morphine, it's an analgesic, so it's going to reduce pain level, reduce anxiety levels, and because it also dilates the blood vessels, it's also going to reduce preload on the heart and reduce some of that that push into the heart and reduce some of the load there. So reducing the preload also will reduce the need for the heart to push out against a higher and increased blood pressure. Very important to remember that we need to have an IV in place for this because if there are certain locations of cardiac injury, most notably the posterior coronary MIs, also the inferior coronary MIs. If you push morphine or nitrates and reduce that preload, these patients can rapidly lose blood pressure because their injury is on the side of the heart that is providing more preload for the left side. And if they are injured, the only preload they have is what's coming in through the venous system. So we have to be very careful, make sure we're prepared to run a fluid bolus into these patients very quickly if we see signs that they are going to start bottoming out with their blood pressure. Oxygen is a key here. These patients are experiencing decreased oxygenation to their heart muscle. We can increase the percentage of oxygen that's coming into their respiratory system, usually 2 to 4 liters of nasal cannula. It may go up to a non-rebreather mask or some kind of a partial rebreather. You should look and follow whatever guidelines are for your facility. Nitroglycerin, this dilates the cardiac arteries specifically and also causes peripheral vasodilation. So you will see some reduced blood pressure from this as well. And that's why I lump it in with the morphine when you're worried about having a line in place so you can give a fluid bolus if you need to. And finally, aspirin. This is something the patient may already have as part of their daily regimen. And this is because aspirin actually, the best way to put it is it makes the platelets a little more slippery. The platelets, part of that clotting factors that are in the blood, and the platelets will catch on each other because they're a little sticky. Aspirin makes them a little more slippery, and so it's less likely to add on to an existing clot or an existing constriction with more clotting factors. It'll help them slide on by. So that's what aspirin will help with. Some other interventions just to keep in mind. We want to decrease the patient's anxiety. Anything that makes them more anxious means that their sympathetic nervous system is kicking in, increasing their heart rate, increasing their oxygen demands for their heart and other key systems in the body. We don't want that. So we want to decrease their anxiety, keep things to a dull roar around them, nothing that's going to excite them. You know, if they're a football fan, probably shouldn't be watching the football game if they just came in with an acute case of chest pain and an MI. Reduce their general oxygen demand. This is one of those few cases where we actually want the patient to be remaining in bed, not moving around a whole lot on their own. We bring things to them in these cases. And then once we've treated the underlying MI causes with a artery bypass of some type, if we go in and are doing a catheterization, all of these things, we can afterwards get them up and moving around according to protocols, but we want to make sure initially that we are not doing anything to increase the amount of oxygen demand, such as making them move around a lot. So we want to do a lot of the work for them. Finally, frequent reassessment of these patients, assessing their pain status, assessing them for shortness of breath, looking at their skin color, work of breathing, and monitoring trends in their vital signs are all very important follow-ups for these patients. And that's going to wrap up this week's episode of The Nursing Show. I want to remind everybody that you need to check back in for the show notes for everything discussed in this episode. All of the news items, tip files, and other links mentioned are all available in the show notes for this and every other episode. And you need to follow up on the information because I can provide only general information here. It's your job to follow the links and look at the resources and see how they apply to your own scope of practice. I'll do my job here and get you as much information as I can. It's your job to follow up, make sure that the information gels with what you know and what you're supposed to be doing in your area. I'd like to urge all of you to comment and get back in touch with me here at The Nursing Show. You can reach me, of course, by leaving comments over at nursingshow.com. There are comment links at the bottom or near the top of every single article. You can also reach me by email, comments@nursingshow.com. And you can also get a hold of me over at Facebook, facebook.com/podmedic, or you can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/podmedic. That's it for me. I'll close out the show with some great PodSafe music. This week, Matthew Ebel's Downtown. If you like what you hear, let him know you heard it here on The Nursing Show. And I'll be back again next week with another brand new episode here of The Nursing Show. And in the meantime, I want to remind you all that I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. And don't forget, please stay safe and stay tuned here to The Nursing Show. Take care.
Schoolgirl, she grew up in the heart of an air-conditioned world. Hell, he gives you money, but honey, your daddy don't give a damn unless you got a Johnny.